What I'm going to endeavor to do this hour is to speak on the historicity of Old Testament materials, and particularly the so-called documentary hypothesis as to the origins of the material in the first five books of the Bible. And after I've said something about this, then I'm going to talk about the implications of this for the reliability of the accounts that you find in the early material in the Bible. This is going to take us to a few remarks on the miraculous, since these accounts contain miraculous events. And then this will lead on to the question of the uniqueness of the Old Testament message and the relationship of Hebrew to Greek thought. Later on in this course, you're going to deal with the thought of the Greeks. You're going to be comparing and contrasting this with Hebrew thought, and I want to make a few remarks on that at the end of the period. Obviously, it's not possible to do very much with this kind of a topic in such a short time, and for this reason, I have made available some materials which presumably you've received. There are three pieces of material which I hope everybody has obtained. One of these is a mimeographed essay by a graduate student of mine. This essay is going to be published in a book later on this year. The other two materials I have done myself. One of them is an essay dealing with McNeil's Rise of the West, and you're reading sections of this in connection with your course. The other is a printed article entitled History and Christianity, which applies some of the points I'm going to make this period to the problem of New Testament material, to the problem of New Testament reliability, New Testament historicity. Are there people here who have not received this mimeographed article, the mimeographed material? Anybody has that? No? I don't know who's doing the distributing, but maybe you could bring a couple of copies down here. How about the Xerox? This is a legal size affair. How many have not received that? Approximately the same people. And what about the printed article, History and Christianity? How many have not gotten that? Again, it's the same people, so they're more or less located in that section. Let me begin then with the problem of documentary theories as to the origin of the early biblical material. Undoubtedly, you have had the documentary hypotheses described in class. I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes in indicating what these theories are, and then I'm going to go on to a criticism of them. The origin of documentary theories in regard to the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, comes with the French physician Jean Astruc, A-S-T-R-U-C, in the 18th century. This physician noted that two different names were used for God in Genesis 1 and 2, and that that these two names were used in different situations in the first five books of the Bible, and he concluded from this that the author of this material had relied upon prior sources in order to produce his narrative. Astruc felt that the editor of this material was probably Moses, but he was reasonably certain that the material had originated elsewhere and that the material had been brought together and worked into a single narrative as we have at the present time. By 1780, toward the end of the 18th century, J.G. Eichhorn, E-I-C-H-H-O-R-N, J.G. Eichhorn, a German scholar, specified two different strands of documents, two different strands of material entering into the Pentateuch. These correspond to what later came to be known as the J and the E sources, J standing for the material that used Jehovah or Yahweh as the name for God, and E, the strand of material using the Hebrew word Elohim for God. Eichhorn felt that this stuff had not been written or edited by Moses at all, but rather it was of post-Mosaic authorship. In other words, the material had been attributed to Moses, but was not actually Mosaic. Then, early in the 19th century, another German scholar by the name of De Wette, D-E-W-E-T-T-E, isolated still another source, which came to be called D for Deuteronomic, or Deuteronomy. This was the material primarily comprising the book of Deuteronomy as we have it now, and De Wette said that instead of this material having been written by Moses, it was actually written as late as the 7th century, and it was conveniently discovered at the time of a religious and political reform in the 17th century, 7th century, this reform known as Josiah's reform. The idea was that the Hebrew monarch wanted to centralize the government, and there is nothing like a good religious centralization to help with a political centralization. And so, conveniently, this material was produced and discovered, as if it had been written by Moses, but discovered at that point, to assist in this operation. The date that De Wette set for the D material was 621, the time of Josiah's reform. Then, another German scholar by the name of Hupfeld, H-U-P-F-E-L-D, in the middle of the 19th century, split the E material, the Elohim material, into two sources. He felt that this material actually derived from two sources, and as a result of this split, a fourth source came into the picture, and this is the P source, or priestly material. Hupfeld was convinced that the order of this material was P, E, J, and D. First the priestly, then the Elohistic, then the Yahwehistic, and finally the Deuteronomic. The final, or let's say the classic formulation of documentary theory, came with three other German scholars, Graf, Keenan, and Wellhausen, at the end of the 19th century. They really added little to this basic formulation, but they realigned the order of the documents in accordance with evolutionary thinking. The middle of the 19th century, of course, is the period of the rise of evolutionary theory, and Wellhausen especially was convinced that there had been an evolution of Hebrew religion from primitive animism to the point of high ethical monotheism. So he ranged the sources to illustrate this kind of progress. And the order of the material for Wellhausen was J, E, D, and P. J, E, D, and P. This so-called Wellhausen theory, or the J, E, D, P theory, has been held very, very widely in theological scholarship, and most of the encyclopedic treatments of the subject, for example, the Interpreter's Bible, takes this theory for granted. I want to point out, and one of the major purposes of this lecture is to point out, that there are some very severe difficulties with this kind of analysis, and that there are trends and tendencies in biblical scholarship at this point leading to a rejection of this kind of analysis. The reason for this has been some careful work on this theory, especially by Scandinavian and Jewish scholars. These people have done further analysis of the whole question, and the result has been some very severe criticism of the whole concept of documentary analysis. And this has a direct bearing not only on the first five books of the Bible, but on such materials as the book of Isaiah in the Old Testament, and also the way in which New Testament material is handled. So this is of great consequence for determining the degree of reliability which is to be attached to material in the Bible. Let me mention some of the Scandinavian scholars that have opposed this kind of documentary analysis, and then I want to mention a Jewish scholar, cite his work, and then go on to indicate why these people have felt that the documentary hypothesis should be rejected. In Scandinavian scholarship, we have Sigmund Mowinckel, M-O-W-I-N-C-K-E-L, a Norwegian, who argues that the separation between J and E simply can't be maintained. J and E cannot be treated as two separate sources that have been collated, edited, brought together at a later point. Johannes Petersen, a Dane, and Ivan Engnell, a Swede, have argued that documentary criticism is essentially a Procrustean bed, a modern Procrustean bed into which ancient Semitic material has been slapped. Now, you remember the old bed of Procrustes in Greek mythology. Procrustes had a bed of a certain size, and he just loved to receive guests. It didn't make any difference what size the guest was. He was put into the bed whether he liked it or not. If the person was too small for the bed, Procrustes stretched him until he fitted. And if he were too long, Procrustes chopped him off at either end until he fitted. In the opinion of Petersen and Engnell, the documentary theories are a Procrustean bed into which this Semitic material is forced, regardless of the tensions that this produces. And for them, the major reason for the success of this theory was a naive feeling that because biological evolution had evidence going for it, that therefore there had to be an evolution of religious knowledge. This is, of course, a highly questionable kind of notion. Those of you living in California have contact with many modern sects and cults. In fact, this is a kind of elephant's graveyard of sects and cults out here, and I'm sure you recognize that religion has not evolved as the country has evolved. We don't particularly have higher levels of religiosity out here in more modern California. The fact of the matter is that religious development does not seem to go on a straight line basis. In Jewish scholarship, we have the work of Kasuto. This work has just recently been translated into English from Hebrew. It is published by the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and is a detailed examination of the documentary hypothesis. The title of it is The Documentary Hypothesis, and this author you certainly ought to know. The Scandinavian material is very difficult to get at. Much of it has not been translated from Scandinavian languages, or if it has, it's generally been translated into German, so it still poses a problem for most English readers. This, however, is available. Now, why has the documentary hypothesis been put in question? I've already mentioned the evolutionary hypothesis, which certainly is not a very adequate basis for such reasoning as this. But there are other considerations that are even more important. First of all, ironically, the documentary theories lack documentary support. That is, we do not have any documents from Old Testament times supporting the prior existence of these sources. We don't have, in other words, a hunk of J material, or a hunk of E material, or D or P. We have no instance of finding materials, manuscripts, for example, that would bring together the material that supposedly has originally consisted of J and now has been spread through the first five books of the Bible. The earliest texts of biblical material that we presently have are holistic texts. They are complete texts in the form in which we have them today. In fact, the earliest Old Testament work that we have, the oldest manuscript, is a manuscript of the book of Isaiah, and the documentary theories have operated there in claiming that there are two or perhaps three Isaiahs, but our earliest manuscript shows no break whatever at the points where the Isaiahs supposedly had been brought together into one single document. This means that there is no external manuscript evidence to support these theories. The theories are based upon internal literary reading of the text as we have them. And this means a corresponding subjectivity in the results. There is, in fact, a tremendous amount of conflicting opinion in regard to these documentary theories. You have heard of J, E, D, and P by way of the classic theory. Perhaps you haven't heard that there are any number of other supposed sources that enter into this picture, and which have been maintained by various scholars in this area. For example, Otto Eichsfeld holds that there is an L document which accounts for some of the material. R.H. Pfeiffer, late professor at Harvard, argued for an S document. Julius Morgenstern claimed that there was a K document. When I was taking my theological work a few years ago, there was a question as to whether K ought to be split into K and K sub 1. In other words, whether even that source was really a uniform source in itself. The result of this is that it's been practically impossible for advocates of documentary theories to come to any agreement as to where one source stops and another source begins. An attempt was made a number of years ago to produce a polychrome Bible, which would use different colors of type in order to show where one source left off and another began. This work was never produced, and the reason was that nobody could come to an agreement as to the color scheme. And this wasn't simply an aesthetic problem. It was a problem knowing where one color should not be used and another color should be used. Now, what this suggests is that the operation is highly subjective and depends upon the way in which the particular documentalist reads the material. This brings us to the principle that Aristotle employed for working with any literary material. And this principle is a classic principle. It's a principle which operates whether you're working with biblical material or not, or ought to work, and it's this: that you give the benefit of doubt to the stuff that you have, to the stuff that you're working with. You give the benefit of the doubt to the document that you are analyzing or interpreting. Aristotle was very much disturbed when he wrote the Poetics that so many people had gone in and hacked up the Iliad and the Odyssey. They had pointed out errors and contradictions and evident sources and the like, and Aristotle's attitude was, look, why don't we just take this thing as it claims to be, as a unified piece of literature, and see if we can handle the problems on that basis, instead of chopping the whole business up. And Aristotle quite readily handled a number of supposed contradictions and problems on that basis. The principle here is that the critic should not arrogate the benefit of the doubt to himself and to his theory. He should rather give the benefit of the doubt to the material that he's working with. This, in turn, connects with another principle, which is the parity principle. That is, that the simplest explanation of problems in dealing with a text ought to be employed rather than the more complex. If you can handle the problems on the basis of a simple operation, then there is no point in appealing to a very complex or highly subjectivistic operation. And what this means in practice is that if you can deal with the problems that have given rise to documentary thinking without appealing to imaginary documents, you're better off. And I want to talk about some of these problems and how they can be handled on the basis of the text itself. For example, one of the main supports of documentary theory is the divine names, the use of one name for God in one portion of the Pentateuch and another name for God in another portion. The two names in question here are Yahweh, or Jehovah, on the one hand, and Elohim on the other. Now, Casuto has analyzed in great detail the use of these two terms for God in biblical literature and in extra-biblical Hebraic literature, and he has come to the conclusion that the reason why you have, for example, Elohim employed in Genesis 1 and Yahweh employed when you get to Genesis 4, and why you have Yahweh Elohim, the combined form, in Genesis 2 and 3 is simply due to the different meanings of these two terms. In other words, one author would perfectly well have chosen to do this simply to make a point. The term Elohim is the most general word for God. It is the term that refers to God as creator of the physical universe. The term Yahweh is the personal name of God, the name of God as related to the Hebrew people primarily. Now, says Casuto, what could be more natural than for the writer to begin his account, the creation, with the more general term for God, Elohim, and then when he gets to Genesis 4, which narrows the situation down to the particular and God's dealings with it, to shift over to the term Yahweh and to use the combined expression, Elohim Yahweh, or Yahweh Elohim, the Lord God, as it appears in the translations, to connect this material in Genesis 2 and 3. Yes. Yeah, that's determined by way of the contexts in which the word appears and by the Greek words that were employed in translating it when the Jews translated the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek in Alexandria. The Septuagint translation uses different words here, and you can make comparisons and work out inductively the significance of these terms in that fashion. In other words, this is not a circular reasoning based upon the passage itself. It's a matter of analyzing these two terms as they appear in literature for which there is no question along these lines. Now, what about the alleged contradictions and doublets? Those who have argued for documentary theory have felt that because of double accounts, or apparently double accounts, it's necessary to say that there were several different sources brought together by one editor. Well, it's possible to deal with these alleged contradictions and doublets on the basis of the text itself if one reads the language very carefully and closely, if one sees exactly what the text is saying. I'll just give one example. The documentalists hold that in the J source, the flood lasts only 40 days, whereas in the P source, it lasts 150 days, and the late 10th century editor simply pasted these accounts together in a rather sloppy fashion, and therefore you have an account which contradicts itself and which says that on the one hand the flood lasted 40 days and on the other hand the flood lasted 150 days. As an example of how this can be handled on the basis of the text itself, Gleason Archer, whose Old Testament introduction was published just a couple of years ago, he is a Harvard PhD and has done a great deal of work in this area, has this to say: a consecutive reading of the whole narrative makes it apparent that the author, the one author, put the length of the downpour itself at 40 days, whereas the prevalence of the water level above the highest portions of the land surface endured for 150 days. And Archer notes that in Genesis 7:24, which is supposedly the P source, you don't have anything stated about raining during the entire period. In other words, this has to do with water level. It doesn't have to do with the actual dropping of rain from above. Now, this is simply one example of how it's possible to handle this kind of problem without appealing to a late editing of conflicting sources. Then there is the matter of differing emphases. There appear to be differing emphases in the text at points. Here, Casuto points out quite rightly that differing emphases depend a great deal on the way you read the passage. That is, there are writings produced by one author, most definitely produced by one author, in which there are changes in emphasis owing to the fact that the author wants to emphasize two different things. This does not mean that the material is necessarily written by two different people. Casuto cites Dante's Divine Comedy as an example. There are instances in the Divine Comedy, and Casuto goes into quite a bit of detail on this, where you could develop priestly and Deuteronomic sources, where you could say the material obviously reflects an emphasis on the law here, and at another point it stresses a priestly kind of operation. Now, says Casuto, the only trouble with this is that there was only one author. It was Dante, and we know this on the basis of external checking. There are other examples of this. If you take Goethe's Faust Part 1 and Goethe's Faust Part 2, and you did not know that these were written by Faust, I guarantee that on this kind of differing emphasis argument, you would conclude that they were written by two different people. Fact of the matter is, Dante had two different points to make, if you will. I hope that the documentalist kind of mentality does not operate when, after an atomic attack, my writings turn up in 2,000 years, because if that's the case, I'm sure people will be convinced that not just one person did this. If they find, for example, my love letters and my scholarly articles, they will be very much convinced that two different people performed this operation. In the case of student term papers, there's no difficulty at all in determining multiple authorship. The only trouble there is that in certain cases it is multiple authorship. But the point is that we all change our literary style depending upon the point we're trying to make, and we are not always making precisely the same point. C.S. Lewis, who spent his career in literary studies, was convinced that this kind of documentary method was very much off base. He wrote an essay which was published posthumously, and I want to read you a quotation out of this because it's very much relevant to this. Lewis operated in medieval and Renaissance English studies, and he compared the operations there with the operations that go on in biblical criticism. This is what he has to say. "Now I must first record my impression, then distinct from it, what I can say with certainty. My impression is that in the whole of my experience, when people did this sort of thing with Lewis's writings, when reviewers tried to determine his sources, says he, not one of these guesses has on any one point been right. The method shows a record of 100% failure. You would expect that by mere chance they would hit as often as they miss. But it is my impression that they do no such thing. I can't remember a single hit. And yet, they would often sound, if you didn't know the truth, extremely convincing. Many reviewers said that the ring in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings was suggested by the atomic bomb. What could be more plausible? Here is a book published when everyone was preoccupied by that sinister invention. Here in the center of the book is a weapon which it seems madness to throw away, yet fatal to use. Yet, in fact, the chronology of the book's composition makes the theory impossible." Now, this surely ought to give us pause. The reconstruction of the history of a text, when the text is ancient, sounds very convincing. But one is, after all, sailing by dead reckoning. The results cannot be checked by external evidence. In order to decide how reliable the method is, what more could you ask for than to be shown an instance where the same method is at work, and we have facts to check it by? Well, that's what I've done. And we find that when this check is available, the results are either always, or else nearly always, wrong. The assured results of modern scholarship, in quotes, which is a favorite phrase used in this kind of criticism, the assured results of modern scholarship, says Lewis, as to the way in which an old book was written, are assured, we may conclude, only because the men who knew the facts are dead and can't blow the gap. Lewis also goes on to point out that if people have this much trouble in isolating sources in contemporary material in their own frame of reference, if they miss as extensively as they do, what about people today who are attempting to analyze the mentality, the mindset of people who are writing 4,000 years ago? This becomes even more difficult. Then there's another consideration that has caused many people to move away from this kind of analysis. The same method has collapsed in other fields where it has been attempted. This kind of approach was used in comparative Near Eastern studies, in Ugaritic literature, for example, for a while, but it was given up. And the reason was that the thing fell into utter subjectivity. It was used in classical studies to a very large extent. In the 19th century, the documentary approach, the fragmentary approach, was very extensively used. When I majored in classics at Cornell University, things had gotten to the point where people were not using this very much anymore, and one of my professors, somewhat of a wag, said, we've arrived at the conclusion that if Homer did not write the Odyssey, it was written by someone else of the same name who lived about the same time. This essay by Professor Yamauchi of Rutgers goes into what has happened to documentary criticism outside the biblical field, and it's very instructive. Composition and corroboration in classical and biblical studies. And the conclusion that he comes to is that people within the theological field would do a great deal better if they would see what has happened to this same method outside of the field. He talks about a peculiar paradox of conservative, radical scholarship. That is, that radical scholarship in dealing with the Old Testament has been very conservative in hanging on to a method that simply will not hold up in other fields. He quotes Cyrus Gordon in the classic work on Ugaritic literature. Says Gordon, "The criterion of variant names, specifically for God, as an indication for differences of authorship, must be drastically discounted in the light of Ugaritic literature. In one and the same poem, Baal may be called Baal, Alim Baal, Dagon's son, Rider of Clouds, etc. If it be argued that these are not different names, but simply a name and its epithets, this cannot be said of the alternation of Baal and Had. Indeed, the parallelistic nature of the poetry calls for variant names. Elohim and Yahweh need not imply dual authorship in a chapter of the Bible any more than Baal and Had do in Ugaritic myth." Now, what's the conclusion that we draw from all of this? The conclusion is that if the Pentateuch was not written by Moses, it was probably written by someone of the same name who lived about the same time. That is, we can't engage in this kind of separatism and get anywhere from a scholarly standpoint. We are not saying that there is not some editing of this material. There is. For example, we have the phrase in this material, after a place name is mentioned, "and this is continued unto this day." Now, that is obviously a statement made by an editor. Today, that would have been put in a footnote or in a margin, but the footnote system was not known at the time, and it was not in any way illegitimate to add a phrase like this. The account of Moses' death was almost certainly not written by Moses, but this is appended to material which is best regarded as of Mosaic authorship. Archer sets forth 7 or 8 reasons why Moses would have been an ideal person to have carried out this little activity. He had the education, the background for authorship, since he received from his ancestors that wealth of oral law which originated from the Mesopotamian cultures back in the time of Abraham. And from his tutors in the Egyptian court, he received training in those branches of learning in which 18th dynasty Egypt excelled the rest of the ancient world. From his forebears, he would naturally have received an accurate oral tradition of the career of the patriarchs and those revelations which God had vouchsafed to them. He would have had a personal knowledge of the climate, agriculture, and geography of Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula, such as the author of the Pentateuch so patently displays, etc., etc., etc. Well, what are the implications of this for the question of the reliability of the narrative? This does not necessarily validate Cecil B. DeMille's productions or make Carlton Heston an accurate depiction of Moses wandering around in the Near East. But what it does do is to put this material into the primary source atmosphere of the events themselves, so that when we read this material, we are actually reading accounts of what happened. We are not reading late traditions that have been sloshed together by a rather an editor whose knowledge is less than adequate. So, for example, when we come across the crossing of the Red or Reed Sea, we don't have a narrative which has been stuck in later to impress the reader. We have an account, evidently, written by a person who had contact with this kind of thing. Now that, of course, puts us immediately to the question of the miraculous, since there is miraculous material recorded here. In the essay on History and Christianity, which you've received, I've said something to this question of the miraculous, and here I want to emphasize the following point. The issue as to whether miracles have occurred is not an issue that can ever be determined by sitting in an armchair and engaging in philosophical speculation on the question. The question as to whether miraculous events have occurred depends squarely on whether there is accurate recording of testimony in connection with them. Nobody but nobody knows the universe so well as to be able to sit back and say, this can't happen. The revolution in physics through Einstein has changed our attitude toward natural law. We don't think any longer as Newton did, and Hume's argument against the miraculous falls in that context, that there is a tight structure of natural law that is never violated. Natural law is nothing but our generalization on the basis of experience. And if there is sufficiently good evidence that unique events occur, well, by George, we have to take this into account. Otherwise, we are like the old farmer who came across a hippopotamus, and he looked at the beast and he said, there ain't no such animal. It didn't fit in with his normal experience, and therefore the thing couldn't exist. Well, if there is enough evidence that certain events of a very peculiar nature occurred, then one had jolly well better take this into account in setting out one's view of what did occur. Why is all of this important? Why should it be important whether these documents are of good quality? Why should it be important whether the miraculous accounts should be taken seriously? Well, I think the reason for this, the significance of this, lies in the point which this material makes. The material claims that at a certain point in history, and through the history of a particular people, God actually touched earth, and he did certain things for men that men desperately need. People needed the deliverance that is recorded in the account of the Israelites being delivered from Egypt, and accounts of deliverance of this sort point us on toward New Testament times, where the deliverance with a capital D is set out. This is the deliverance that is provided through God in Christ. And if you think that the historical evidence is worth considering at all as far as the Old Testament material is concerned, let me emphasize that the documentary materials in relation to the New Testament are infinitely better than the Old Testament material. That is, the documentary evidence, the textual evidence for the soundness of the New Testament accounts is of such a nature that most classicists would give their eye teeth to have comparable evidence in support of classical authors. And that kind of evidence I've gone into in some detail in this essay on history and Christianity. By the way, that essay originated in a dialogue I had with Professor Stroll when he was a professor at the University of British Columbia in Canada, and there are references to him and to his viewpoint in this essay, so I think you'll find it of some value in that regard, of some interest at least. Now let me say a couple of words in conclusion about the uniqueness of the Old Testament message and the relation of this to Greek thought. And this will be very, very brief, obviously. In recent years, a lot of work has been done on the unique character of the biblical message. It used to be, in the 19th century when the documentalists were operating, that the Old Testament was considered a kind of chameleon that changed color in relation to any situation it touched. In the Near Eastern world. It's now seen that the Old Testament material is remarkable in its difference from the Semitic, from the non-Semitic material in the same environment. A name that you ought to know is the name of G. Ernest Wright. He's also a professor at Harvard, and these two books, The Challenge of Israel's Faith and The Old Testament Against Its Environment, are very, very valuable. The book, The Old Testament Against Its Environment, speaks about what the Old Testament is doing in contrast to the environment in which these events took place. And Wright points out that the message of this Old Testament material is 180 degrees removed from the sort of thing that was common in the Near East when it was presented. In one of the courses I'm giving in philosophy of history, I point out what many secular philosophers of history have, that the very notion of history beginning at a point and proceeding in a linear fashion toward a goal, that very idea originates in the biblical context. In the ancient Near East, there was a mythical view of history. When you come to the Greeks, they have a cyclical view of history. But the idea of history proceeding, of there being a progress in history, our very concept of progress in that regard, derives ultimately from this material. Canadian philosopher George P. Grant has said that without that biblical material, we'd be hard put to find any source for the very concept of progress that has become so basic to modern thinking. and Grant is no Christian or arguing from a theological standpoint. Now, how about the contrast between biblical and Greek thought? When you get into Greek thought, you'll find that the relationship between the ultimate and man can be summarized as an arrow going up. That is, man, through intellectual effort or mystic experience or some combination of the two, rises up into contact with the ultimate. In Platonic philosophy, he can rise up to the realm of the ideas or ideal. In Neoplatonism, this is achieved by a mystic experience, pretty largely. Aristotle's God is the top rung of a ladder, each step of which is concerned only with what's higher. Since Aristotle's God is incapable of loving anybody higher, since he's at the top of the heap, he spends eternity loving himself. It's sort of a cosmic narcissism. Now, in the biblical material, you get a reverse of this kind of operation. You get a notion of the ultimate, God, coming down to man and meeting man in his need. The Greek word eros has been associated with the kind of love that rises up to get some benefit from the higher. The term agape in Greek, which is used in the New Testament, speaks of God coming down and meeting man in his need. This is a contrast of great significance. In the Old Testament, you have the story of the Tower of Babel, where people try and build a tower to get up to heaven. Well, their architects don't do a very hot job, and the tower is not completed, and in fact, their language is confused. Their tongues are confused. The point being that people who try and scramble up to God eventually find that they cannot make it. This is like trying to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. In the biblical religion, the emphasis is placed upon God coming down to man, that is, moving into man's situation. We're not thinking here in terms of a spatial heaven sitting up there. We're talking in terms of God entering the human situation and dealing with man's need where man is. Now, there's another way that you can look at this, a more positive way for the benefit of the Greeks, if you will. This moving upward is an indication of the Greeks' recognition of their need. They did need to come into contact with the ultimate. The trouble was, as human beings, they weren't able to manage this. They deserve high praise for recognizing their need. The sad thing is that so many moderns think that they don't need this kind of thing. St. Augustine said, and quite rightly, that everybody has a God-shaped blank in him. It's as if you were a puzzle, a picture puzzle with one piece missing. And this peculiar piece that's missing happens to be exactly God-shaped. That is, that piece is necessary to fit in order for the whole business to come out as it ought to. Augustine put it this way in his Confessions. He said, and the Confessions are in the form of a prayer, Thou, O God, hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. Now, it's that kind of restlessness that is exemplified by this striving upward. But when a person recognizes that restlessness, he also recognizes that he cannot solve this dilemma himself. And thus, the biblical solution to the whole business comes in, which is that God, seeing man in his need, came down. Greater love hath no man than this, that he give his life for his friends, and that's exactly what God did in predicting his coming in the Old Testament and finally coming and dying on the cross in the New Testament. All right, we're open for a few questions at the tail end of the period. Does a bell ring or... About 3 minutes. All right. Yes. I'll repeat the question if you can't hear it. Yeah. Yes. The question is, when attempts have been made to check the documentary material in the Old Testament against external sources, what's been the result? Well, I'll give you reference on this. There is a work entitled The Bible as History by Werner Keller. He is a German who has summarized the results of archaeological work dealing with the Old Testament over the last 75 years. And the history of this thing has been the validation again and again and again of the Old Testament material as archaeological material has come to light. For example, back at the time of the Graf Keenan Bellhausen theory, people said Moses couldn't possibly have written this stuff because that far back people couldn't even write. Now, as a result of archaeological investigation carried on in Egypt, it's been shown that so much writing was going on that even toilet articles had long inscriptions. The Egyptians were just fascinated with writing. They wrote on everything, you see. For them, graffiti was a kind of national sport. And there was absolutely no problem at all in this regard. Anything else? Anyone have another animal you'd like to take out? No? Any other questions? Yeah. Ugaritic is a language and a literature. It's a comparative Semitic language and has a literature of its own. Now there is a branch of Near Eastern linguistic and literary scholarship known as Ugaritic scholarship. The reason I cited this is that this material comes from the same general period as the biblical material, and an attempt was made to try documentary theories on that literature, you see, to separate out sources on the basis of divine names. But as Cyrus Gordon, who is the world expert in Ugaritic literature, says, when this was attempted, the result is that it failed. And therefore, this gives even less reason for using this in the case of biblical materials. Yeah, the question is why the number 40 used so much. Well, the number 40 certainly does have a symbolic value. There's no doubt about this. The various numbers employed in the Bible are of symbolic significance. And 40 is a number that corresponds to the length of a particular period of spiritual experience. For example, the period of 40 days appears in the New Testament as well as the Old. But the fact that the number has symbolic value doesn't mean that somebody fudged the narrative to bring it to 40. See? Often that kind of illogic has been used. If the number is symbolic, clearly somebody fixed it up so it would read 40. Well, fact of the matter is that many numbers were symbolic, and the symbolism builds on the historicity. The historicity is not used as a device for affecting some clever symbolism. Okay, one more question. I'm sorry, is that all right? Yes. Yes. Yeah, the question here is, what about the material that was passed down orally, by oral tradition, to the time of the writing of the Pentateuch? Here, one point I think is very important to recognize, and it's this. We think today that the human memory is a very inadequate source of transmission, and the reason is that we have come to rely upon everything from pencils to stennerettes, so that our memories are not used to a very great extent. But in a time when writing materials were not common, prior to this, you see, the memory was used extensively and had remarkable powers. It was said, even at the time of Christ, that a rabbi was like a plastered cistern, which did not refer to the consumption of alcohol or anything like that, that he did not lose a drop. In other words, he could listen to a narrative and he could reproduce it. I don't know if you realize this, but Macaulay, the historian, had memorized the whole of Paradise Lost. There was once a bet as to whether he could recite all of this, and when they were leaving Scotland, he started, and he had reached book 6, line something or other, when they had gotten to the French coast. The fact is that people of that early time retained material and passed it on with amazing accuracy. That's what's been discovered, for example, in the examination of epic poems, epic literature, that there is very little loss. It isn't fair to play this parlor game of whispering something to your neighbor and then he passes it on, and when you get to the end of the line, it's very different to say, well, obviously, this early biblical material is silly. You are whispering to people who find it difficult to remember a telephone number 5 minutes after they've heard it, because they're living in a modern culture where there is very little stress on memorization or the retention of material. You don't have to do it, so you don't do it. All right, thank you very much.
I'd like to thank Professor Montgomery.